Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at about 8 p.m., we get together in front of our radios, and we chat. We talk to each other. We explain things to each other. We learn from each other, and hopefully we're a bit entertained by each other. So that's what the Limark Technical Net is. And I thank you for coming back this Sunday night at 8 p.m. to join me on another attempt to pull it off. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, that would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are the questions people would email in because they couldn't make it to the Technical Net on the radio. Or if you have expertise in a topic that has come up in the news and you'd like to share it with us, or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for interesting puzzles to stimulate discussion. Or if you have Okay, well, one second, guys. I got to do a little bit of adjusting on the computer. Okay, had to fix something on the computer. Anyway, getting back, if you want to contact Paul yourself for any space-related or NASA-related subject that you'd like him to expound on during the SpaceNet report, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, every week I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles that come across my computer screen, and I share them with you. You can get to it by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you access to my link page. And it's open 24/7, so you don't have to go to it today or tomorrow. You can go to it next week or next month whenever you're bored and want to be a little entertained by some interesting articles, my humble opinion. Anyway, there's a chat room available. It's been a little quiet lately, but we'll see what happens. You can get to it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. We offer an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and I leave it open the rest of the week so that it could be an access point if you have the Internet signal, but you don't have radio contact with the repeater. You can listen in on Glen Oaks by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, I always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It's had over a million visits, and it has archives of this Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So there's a lot of recorded wisdom from amateur radio operators who have moved out of the area and some who have unfortunately become silent keys and passed on. So avail yourself of Mike's great site and listen to past technical nets. Again, go back as far as 2006. So that's the usual links. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, we got a regular standard operating night tonight. I will ask if there are any questions or comments or topics. I hope there will be. I hope there will be a few amateur radio related, because that's what kind of makes this all work. This is not a monologue. This is not a broadcast. This is a net to discuss technical issues. So I hope people will avail themselves of this. Hopefully that should take us to about 10:15. Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report, which will take us approximately to about 11 o'clock. I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan if everything continues to work. There's a lot of moving parts in this, surprisingly, and every so often one of them seizes up. So I hope that won't be the case tonight. So with all that in mind, We're open for questions or comments or topics for discussion. Hit that push to talk and say hello and ID yourselves. Recognized. Hello, Wes. Anyone else have any questions or any topics or any comments for tonight? Well, I perceive a pattern. I don't know if it's a summer pattern or it's just suggestions of things to come. Again, this is not a broadcast. This is not a performance. This is a net, and we thrive on interacting with people. So the more topics and the more questions and more comments, I think it makes for a better technical net. Perhaps I'm incorrect in that. So once again, if anyone else out there has any questions or topics or comments for tonight, please hit that push to talk. Okay, the sounds of silence. Well, Wesley, you're up. What do you got for us today?
Yeah, I sent you a number of emails with number of subject that are worth to be discussed, and it's up to you what you decide to be discussed. One of them is ham radio related, is underground antennas from 1 to 50, from 1 to 50 megahertz, but actually is from 1 hertz to 50 megahertz, to say that, although it sounds strange. So the antenna is completely buried. If you had a chance to look at the material, we can discuss it. If not, then we can go to the other and leave it for later. In the subject to be discussed, I would love to have the help of Paul and yours, eventually Jeff, if it's possible. One of the other subject is, let me jump. The other subject is about gold and gold origin. Everybody wants to have a gold, at least for the loved one, and I believe that's interesting. Paul definitely is going to discuss Viper constellation, the moon rover, so that would be great. And is another one for a long time ago, but the interesting fact in it is that two things can happen at the same time. Centimeters, 2 feet, or 2 million miles.
Unfortunately, there's someone playing with their radio. and making the background rather noisy. If anything, could we kind of delay the loafer stuff? Because we've kind of got around this this topic maybe about four or five times in the last 3-4 months. So, you know, maybe we could pick up something in, something different, you know?
Whatever you think is the best. How can you hear me now?
Well, you're fine when that guy isn't playing around in the background. And if he is, he's generating rather loud noise in the repeater.
Yeah, I would appreciate the gentleman to not interfere with that. I mean, it's nothing that is going to come out from the discussion. Doesn't matter who is talking. I do thank you very much for that.
Yeah, sure. So, one of the other subjects that you emailed me, we can discuss. You even mentioned entanglement.
Okay, so ancient quantum riddle. I understood. So, I would love if you refer that. I sent you the material about it, but I don't believe it was necessary for it. It was actually Einstein who was opposing for a long time that something may happen at the same time in space, and it doesn't matter how far away it is, 13 million either light years away or 3 feet away. And there was an experiment that was conducted using two sources that were regulating the filters to make sure that there is no error. I'm not sure. Have you had a chance to see the video, Dr. Wood?
No, I didn't. I mean, the whole subject kind of struck me as weird. There's no real fundamental question, as far as I'm aware, of whether entanglement is a thing or isn't a thing. Colleges regularly demonstrate quantum entanglement as a lab experiment. It's a thing. So again, not quite sure. The problem that people have there's a bunch of problems with entanglement is a concept which seems to be at work, which is non-locality. Common sense would suggest that you can only affect things that you can get into contact with in some way. Don't have to put your hands on it, but you can flash a light at it. In some way, you're making contact with it. So that's locality. And it seems that the quantum mechanics allows for a concept that is termed non-locality, which is that you can interact with things without being spatially close to them. That's the thing that drives a lot of physicists crazy, because it's very non-intuitive. So, and then there's the concept of instantaneous transmission of information, which violates all kinds of interesting laws. So it's how locality manifests itself. Some people believe that non-locality can exist, and one guy won a Nobel award because he pretty much kind of proved non-locality exists. Although there are constraints to it that would defy violation of the information theory that you can instantaneously transfer information anyplace, anywhere, anytime. So, you know, those are the problems. How this particular experiment tests that, I'm unsure. And it certainly, again, there's no warranting in a test, an experiment, to prove entanglement, because it's been proved for 50 years. So, you know, it's kind of like trying to prove gravity.
I may have a different opinion, Dr. Roy. about that. So, Nova. Nova PBS, public broadcast station, a official channel, released ancient quantum riddle, full documentary. So that was called The Spooky Action at the Distance, but today quantum entanglement is poised to revolutionize technology on the computers and cryptography. So Google is working on the quantum computers as well. And we hope that at some time in the future we would be able to use similar technology of that. Let me check. So that what was not uncertain or not proven became proven, and became proven by two independent group of scientists, not related to each other. So, today, physicists say that they became convinced that phenomenon of two subatomic particles that mirror changes each other is instantaneously over any distance real. So, I'm referring to Canary Islands observatory and the experiment and use of quasars. Okay, so it was let me change the power a little bit.
There's no such thing as a quasar. So is it a quasar? What are you talking about?
Quasar. Right. Okay, so let me go to... So, one of the experiments, the international team led by Austrian physicist Anton Zingler has transmitted quantum states between two Canada islands, La Palma and San Fiore, over the distance 143 kilometers. But the previous record set by researchers in China just a few months ago was 97 kilometers. So we not hesitate to use the term quantum teleportation at the distance. We may use that to describe further the experiment. So, the experiment is a major step towards satellite-based quantum communication. So the results have been published in Nature and plenty of other sources. Let me go to this further. Okay. So what they did is they used light from quasars. So they have two observation centers for the stars in the distance of 145 kilometers, which is probably 143 kilometers, which is probably about 97 miles. In each of the points, at some distance from each one of the centers, they installed receivers, and they had a filter. The filters were randomly chosen, and the light from the quasars, two different quasars, you correct my pronunciation, was used to change them. So there was no relation to anything that could actually make an error. So one telescope was directed to 8 billion years quasar, and the other one was directed to another quasar. And what they were he needs to do is to change the filters so the filters could capture one photon. So they sent they sent a light, and they wanted to make sure if that light will arrive at the same very time with no delay at whatsoever to both of those receivers. And that's on the video from Nova. And it happened that they were able, after half of a year of preparation, they were able to do that. And from that, Google and a few other big companies decided that they want to invest more in quantum internet and quantum computer that would eventually serve their needs. So that's the core of the experiment. I do not have an article about the Chinese, but Chinese did it first and did it a few months before before Austrian Academy of Science. Back to you.
Well, once again, I'm not quite sure what the point of this is as opposed to anything else. The problem with quantum computers, if they actually fulfill their promise, and about 9 months ago, I think I did a presentation that kind of made me a wee bit cynical. It's something big companies, you know, it's like Google's version of a Maserati. To show everyone that they have enough money to buy a Maserati, they buy a quantum computer. It hasn't produced any practical results that you can't train a 10-year-old for because of the limitations in the programming and the number of quantum bits and the entanglement of the quantum bits. So, you know, I'm not quite sure what the experiment was. You have to be in possession of particles to put them into entanglement. You cannot entangle two photons from two quasars in two different galaxies. There's nothing in physics that lets you do things like that. So you can trap a photon that's coming from one of those quasars, and you can entangle it with another photon. Perhaps that's what the experiment was. But you can't just kind of say, okay, there's a quasar here, there's a quasar there, we're going to entangle them, and then we're going to do some tests. You got to wait for them to reach us, and when they reach us, then laboratories can entangle particles.
Okay, the text that I have in front of me says, the photons has to be sent directly to the turbulent atmosphere between the two ions, the 143 kilometers. The optical fibers is not suitable for teleportation experiments over the such great distances. A signal loss would be too severe. To reach the goal, the scientists had to implement a series of technical innovations. Support came from the theory group of Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics in Göttingen, Germany, and experimental group of the University of Waterloo, Canada. They said that important step was for a successful teleportation. There was a method known as active feed forward, which were used for the first time in a long distance experiment. It helped us to double the transfer rate in active feed forward protocol. Conventional data is sent along the side to quantum information and enabling the recipient to decipher the transfer signal with the higher efficiency. So the quasars were only used to change the filters. So each one of the receiver had a set of filters. So the quasar light, each of the independent quasar light was used only to change the filter to make sure that there is no error. And those filters were actually randomly able to to stop or to let the single photon to go to each one of the receivers. And that's what I understood. I sent you the video, but if you think that there is a need for you to view that video and eventually discuss it later, that would be good for us. The result of those experiments is that now science is certain 100% that the spooky action over the distance, that what was the wording of Einstein, is possible. Back to you.
Again, 30 years ago, when you asked a theoretical physicist or experimental physicist, he would tell you it's already been proven. So this experiment doesn't prove it exists because it's been known to exist. This experiment at best suggests that you can maintain an entangled particle pair for a certain amount of time so that you can effectively get a signal instantaneously across a longer distance than has been experimentally performed. Because the problem with quantum entanglement is not proving it. Like I said, it's been proved. The problem is maintaining it. It kind of spontaneously unentangles. So any kind of technology to stabilize an entangled pair is a step forward. But it's not proof that entanglement exists because entanglement already was known to exist.
So let's leave it to the next week if you have a time to review the video that I have sent you. I will be appreciating very much if you give us your opinion about it. You said a few times that I'm too optimistic in certain areas, and I agree with you. That's what discussion is about. If everybody says yes, then we have a communist. Okay. The next one. We have NASA that canceled 460 million Viper Moon rover. I believe Paul has a lot to say about it. Or we can go to gold. Whatever you choose, the Tory.
Well, I would imagine he plans to kind of do that on his SpaceNet report. I don't want to steal any of his thunder early into the net. So let's go to the gold and we'll see what develops.
Okay. I believe every minute of Paul is worth attention. It's never too much of Paul. Okay. So we have gold. An interesting thing about gold is that we think that energy that is required to get the gold in form of gold was always available. That's why we have a gold on planet Earth or whatsoever. But we may ask the question, does all the gold in the universe come from stars? Or what was the origin of gold? How the gold was created? And there was a discovery, thanks to Hubble, that put a lot of light on the origin of gold. So, shortly in the material that I have sent you, actually there's a new guy, and I believe the guy is interesting for you to watch, the same as Veritasium and others. So, bank, the energy was converted to mass, the mass was spreaded, and then for stars were created, and some of those stars were so big that actually collapsed under its own gravitational field. So after that, the quasar was created, and after that there was a supernova. But it was calculated that not only one supernova, but two supernovas that could be going around for 10 billion of years, each is needed to create a gold. And then we have quasars. So then we have a supernova, and then we have a gold. That's the whole story. Let me jump. The quasar is the luminous object powered by a supermassive black hole at the center of galaxy. The black hole creates gas and stars, causing intense friction that heats up the surrounding material, emitting massive amounts of light across the electromagnetic spectrum. So quasars are thought to be the brightest object in the universe, outshining entire galaxies. A supernova is the result of the collapsing stars. And it is a catastrophic event occurring when the massive star runs out of fuel and collapses under its own gravity. So that was that was explained in the video. I wonder if did you have a time to look at the video and what's your comment about it?
AC2GS. Yeah, I saw the video. He's okay. Nothing special. After the Big Bang, most of the Big Bang energy is still in the form of energy. Only about 1% of the energy in the Big Bang is believed to have been converted into matter. And mostly hydrogen, some helium, and little traces of lithium and such. And over time, a gravitational attraction cause them to kind of come together and become a big gravitational ball of gas. And when the internal pressures were high enough, the temperatures were high enough, fusion took place, and hydrogen was able to fuse to helium, which produced excess energy, which caused repulsion of the core, otherwise it would all collapse in on itself. So as long as you keep the sun fusing away, the energy created will go into equilibrium with the forces of gravity and maintain the star. Eventually, when you kind of run out of helium and hydrogen to fuel the fusion reaction, sometimes depending upon the size of the star, you can start to fuse heavier atoms, and so you start to fuse helium, and you can fuse carbon, and if the star is big enough, you can fuse everything until you're starting to produce iron. Iron is the last element on the periodic table whose fusion to heavier atoms is exothermic, that produces energy and maintains the reaction of the sun. When you're stuck with only an iron core, you got nothing to fuel anything, because everything else is endothermic. It requires external energy to power it. And so you now have contraction of the iron core of the dead star that's seeing gravitational forces that cause interesting things to happen. Among other things, it causes the creation of neutron stars. It allows for the compression of, it's called electron degeneracy pressure. It allows electrons and protons to fuse together into neutrons. And that is a kind of volatile reaction, explosive, which gives you what we usually, astronomers call a supernova type 2. There is a supernova type 1 as well. Supernova type 2 will cause a massive explosion, which will either leave in its core a neutron star, if it has enough mass for that, or a black hole, if it has even more mass, and a lot of external accretion disks and such, because it's a very unstable thing to do to a star. So the point is that's how it's called nucleosis. It's how atoms get built up from hydrogen and helium and a little lithium into everything up until iron. And the problem then is, how do you go past iron? And so the theory is that, sometimes when these supernovas explode, they probably produce heavier atoms.
Okay. I think it's the last sentence of yours. I assume that you gave me the microphone back. How we can make a gold. A human being can make our gold. But let me check if Dr. Roy is back.
I don't think he's hearing you, Roy. This is WS1.
Yeah,
he's coming in as you're talking.
Yeah, you remember
Roy on Sheldon for not a Glen Oak.
Yeah, it's the same thing that happened to you, Paul. You remember you were talking, and all of a sudden, we kind of lost the link to Glen Oaks.
Right, very good. Yeah, that's why I hear you fine in Selman, but I guess you're not coming out on Glen Oaks.
Oh, I can hear Dr. Roy now.
Okay, it had to reset itself. So anyway, that I was kind of setting things up. Hopefully, enough people heard about it to where you're getting to gold. The neutron star collisions, one of them about 4 years ago, demonstrated creation of gold. The problem is there's been one entire other neutron star annihilation with another neutron star that didn't show it. So on the basis of one. People are rethinking everything. But if you want to tell people how you could make lesser elements into gold, feel free.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Okay. So, we know that to make gold, there is a need for extremely humongous amount of energy. So it looks like humanity doesn't have the power to do that, to do so. However, at Mellor's Brooklyn National Laboratory in California, nuclear chemists, which is, find a way to say, Glenn, physicist Glenn Seaborg, and Wade is a very known scientist, Loveland, used a linear particle accelerated to bombard the bismuth nuclei with very high energy carbon and neon atoms to knock protons and neutrons of the bismuth nuclei for the first time in the history of human beings. Successfully transmitting element into gold before we get excited. We need to mention that it is extremely costly. and there's only a few atoms. So, okay, so it turns out that creating one ounce of gold would cost all money on the earth. $1 quadrillion to make 1 ounce of gold. So it's extremely inefficient. but they did it. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, and if you only want to produce, you know, 9 or 10 atoms worth, it's not quite that expensive, but you know, if you wanted a gram, that would be ridiculous. It's kind of reminiscent when I was a little kid. I used to watch reruns of the black and white Superman television show. And they had one episode that I still remember to this day, although I keep getting the guy's name wrong. It was the character, I think he was Professor Periwinkle or Pepperwinkle. And he had a machine that turned things into gold. And the bad guys stole it from him. And at the end of the show, he finally retrieved it, and he demonstrated it. He took a bar of platinum and put it into the machine, and he got a bar of gold. And he lost money on the deal because the machine would only work on platinum.
Okay. So, a little bit more about gold. How much gold do we have? The Earth's crust alone contains 1.6 parts per million of million, not billion, of gold. Even the Earth's crust has mass about 2.2 times 10 to 19 metric tons. This comes to 35 million metric tons of gold in the Earth. So we have plenty of gold right now for the gold to become less valuable. We are able to find it. So far, the human animal, the human species, were extracted about 200,000 metric tons of gold. So think about it. We extracted 200,000 million tons of gold, but we have 35 million metric tons of gold in the earth. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, but it's not cost-effective to refine it. They're not basing this on hidden deposits of reasonably concentrated sources of gold. They're just going any old bunch of places and averaging the parts per million. In order to kind of scoop up everything, the entire Earth crust, and refine it and remove the gold and then sell it, it probably would again cost you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars and would not be cost effective. The problem is that you have to find minerals in which the mining and refining is less expensive than the cost of selling it, so you make a profit. So the problem is that we don't know how much hidden high concentration gold in the crust there is. We know roughly what the kind of averaging is. And unless someone someday discovers a great way of mining where you just kind of run some magic machine over the surface of the earth and just have it suck the gold out of it, it's not going to be it's not going to be viable. It's not going to be a reasonable return on investment.
I'm going to use some comparison for the people to picture how much gold we have available for us right now that was digged out. So 200,000 metric tons, we may say that if you imagine the Olympic-sized swimming pool and you take four of them, the old gold the humanity ever had could feed in those four full-size swimming pools, and there is nothing comparing to whatever is available. But yes, you're right. but I had a comment on it.
Okay. I was a little bit suspicious of that description. So I looked at the usual descriptions that I've read repeatedly over and over. And apparently the way they like to describe it, and it makes a lot more sense to me, it gives people a better image of how little gold has been found, is that if you take all the discovered gold, you could make a 75-foot by 75-foot cube.
I didn't make a calculation to confirm that, but
yeah, they say it would weigh about 8 times as much as the Statue of Liberty, which I think kind of takes it down to a more imaginable size. You know, I mean, discussing cricket pitches, you know, I mean, I guess if I was born in England, that would mean more to me.
As far as precious materials, in 1998, I had my office in World Trade Center 1 at 77th floor, and we were in geophysics. So we were called by different companies, and we went there. So one of them was El Conevada gold mine, Murari gold mine. We went there, and after 2 hours and one broken tire, we were able to get to the mine. And then they took us to some sort of camper, whatever you name it, and we had to pass exam. And after we passed the exam, we were allowed to get into the mine. So there were two mines there. One mine was underground mine, and the other one was looking like a huge, humongous hole that is going deeper and deeper and deeper. And each step from that serpentine or serpentine was approximately 80 feet by 80 feet. So you could actually take the heavy truck, down. And the lower down you go, the more wide, not more narrow, were the steps. So let's say 100 feet by 100 feet, just a step. And I asked at that time, where is the coal? And the main, one of the supervisors there, he said, well, nobody saw the gold here. I'm working here for 25 years. So I said, so how come you get the gold if you don't see the gold? And they say, well, the gold is here, but it's in the rock. So all of those, you were called because the steps that we used to go down to that place where the gold is in the rock is actually falling down. So we took our measurement equipment, and we were able to find the clay layer on the slope, and when there was the rain actually was slopping over that clay layer and was collapsing that step. So that's what we did. So is it difficult to find the gold? The answer was no, it is not. The gold is everywhere over there. It is just a matter of how much money you put and how much money you waste before it starts to pay for itself. So at that time, they were getting about 50 to 70 kilograms of gold per day. 50 lifted to 70, and the crew was approximately, at least I saw like 17, 18 people working there, and there was the whole mine. Now, after that, they took us to the underground part of the mine. And I asked them, where's the gold? And they see, we cannot show you the gold because we don't see the gold. I say, anything. So he pointed me at a piece of sand in between the rock. And it wasn't gold, it was gray. He said, this is the gold. So I was extremely puzzled for it. But actually, they took us to that part of the gold mine because they had a problem with water. They wanted to find out where the water is, so in case they have flooding, they know where the flooding can come from to prevent the disaster. But anyhow, the conclusion from that was, oh, actually, there was another one, Kennecott Corporation. It was in Utah.
Hey, Wesley.
And it was not a gold mine, it was a copper mine. And they had also the open pit. They told us that they have a similar problem with it. We helped them. We made a good money at that time. But the vice president said, you know what? Those guys that you were just there from the gold mine, they have an easier life than we have. Because we expect to produce the volume. They don't. They are just expected to find the gold. So that is the short story about my experience with gold. Back to you.
Yeah, Wes, Paul wanted to say something.
Just a quick question. Did he say Elk, Nevada? Is that what he said? Is that where it was located?
Elko, Nevada. So Elko, Nevada is actually a very small place with at least one casino, because I didn't know, I didn't see two of them, a humongous one. And then when we were in the plane back to New York, one of the scientists working for me said that he was in Bartow. I say, what? Are you kidding me? He says, yes, I was there. I say, no, that kind of activity is forbidden in the United States. But he said, no, Nevada is exemption of it. So from that I assumed that there are few houses for the workers, and they work mostly in mines, and there is a casino, and there is the bottle. Back to you.
Okay. When I drove out west with my wife, one of the places we stopped was out in Nevada. And there was, you know, there's gambling all throughout the state, except for Carson City, which is weird, the capital. But Elk, you know, had this one casino, probably the same one you're talking about. And, you know, we went in for, you know, you go in for, stop in for coffee, whatever it is. And there's always a machine everywhere in that state. So here's this one machine, put a nickel in, and the thing, a couple extra nickels came out. All right, I do it again, and again, and again, over and over. I had cup full of one nickels that I knew what to do with. So the machine was definitely broke. Sure enough, a guy walked by, you know, that probably owns the place, and he walks into the back room. Next thing you know, the power goes out on the machine. That was the end of that. But yeah, okay, that's probably the same place. One little casino. Anyway, Roy, over to you. WS2N.
The thing is, if you can recall Nevada, Murari Gold Mine, Murari Gold Mine. That's where we were, Murari Gold Mine. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to know. I was just, getting from California, to home, So, anyway, very good. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS. Well, United Gold comes in all kinds of shapes, sizes, and forms. Back in the very old days, when technology was low, you could actually find nuggets of gold. Or you can pan for it in rivers and get flakes of gold. Nowadays, they've industrialized, they've kind of burnt out all the massive collections for the most part. And now it's just a matter of finding other minerals with somewhat higher levels of gold than usual and just kind of grinding it up, sifting through it, and collecting. A lot of these gold mines also collect other minerals as part of the refining process. But sometimes they don't see anything. It's just the substrate. They break out big rocks and they put them through grinders and then put the sludge and stuff through chemical processes that do the refining separations.
I wanted with the discussion to go to quasars and LIGO and Virgo, gravitational wave detectors and Hubble telescopes.
Okay, they're rather diverse, but okay.
Oh, that's exactly gold. That's about gold. Right. So, and that's from the video, We Were Wrong About Gold Origin, by Dr. Ben Miles, M-I-L-E-S. Dr. Ben M-I-L-E-S, Miles. And We Were Wrong About Gold Origin. That's the YouTube video.
Well, once again, I don't really like that because that's popular. That's hyperbole. That's not really what he said. If you listen to what he said, he put in a whole bunch of seems, equivocal terms. He's basing it on the fact that we have witnessed two entire collisions of neutron stars. One of them were highly suggestive of the production of gold, and the other one wasn't. So on the basis of that, I don't think that's proof. That's an indication that something's going on that we should know about. But that wouldn't produce clicks on YouTube. YouTube, like TikTok and all the other things, are just looking for clicks. So I don't care if the guy's got a PhD or what. They're all kind of looking for the same thing, and they bend the rules a little bit. So it's a bit of hyperbole. They haven't proven anything. They've suggested things, but they haven't proven anything.
I love your comments, Dr. Roy. And I do appreciate for it. One guy needs to be a little bit more optimistic so the other can take the stand on it. So I thank you for that. From this transcript, it says the reaction on August 17, 2017, the LIGO and Virgo gravitational wave detectors pick up the signal. The GW170817, and that was followed immediately by the short period gamma ray burst and the killer nova event, and two neutron stars collided. They emitted a massive cloud and of heavy elements. By fighting the observed light curves and spectra from those event, scientists estimated that the total mass of the ejector was found or whatever. So what it says is that it was 5 to 10% of the mass of our sun estimation. All the gold mass based on the total ejection mass predicted. So actually the guy is trying to say how the gold was, if I could use the word, manufactured. this way. Of course, I agree that there is no